Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in docket number 030790, Cynthia Lorenz versus James F. Dunn, M.D.
May it please the court, Mr. David Swack will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. In this case, the beneficiaries of the estate, the creditors, the heirs, etc., have been denied any opportunity for recovery, any trial on the merits in this case, because allegedly the administrator didn't qualify quickly enough. Even though this suit was filed before limitations expired, even though the court-appointed administrator fully participated in the case, and even though the facts of the case never changed, the identity of the defendant never changed, and the defendant was not harmed in any way, and has not been able to show any harm. The Court of Appeals, we think, confused a lot of different concepts in this case and basically came up with a rule that really doesn't make any sense.
Do you agree fundamentally that she had no standing at the time she filed?
Not really, Your Honor, because she had filed an application to probate the estate to open administration prior to the time that the suit was filed. The probate code says that's an interim proceeding. Justice Brister referred to the bankruptcy earlier. I think that it's similar to that. At the time that that petition is filed, that proceeding then covers all the property, all the claims of the estate. It is totally within the control of the probate court, and the probate court appointed an administrator as an officer of the court to take care of that administration for the benefit of the beneficiaries and for the benefit of the heirs, the benefit of the creditors. But as this court said a long time ago in Dowling versus Boyd, it's not for the benefit of people that owe money to the estate. And that's what's going on here.
Would she have had standing even if she had not filed an application for administration?
Well, at some point, the court has to deal with that issue of who's
that,
here to represent the estate.
The question earlier was, did she have standing when suit was filed? And you said yes. And now I'm saying, and you said because an administration application was pending. And I'm asking if an application were not pending, would she still have had standing when she filed the lawsuit?
I think at that point the court would quite properly have said this is a claim of the estate and how do you have capacity to represent this claim of the estate, and if she could not demonstrate that and could not bring anybody forward to represent that claim, and that's what's happened in a lot of cases before the court, when you're faced with a situation where it can't be fixed, then the court has no choice but to dismiss. But that's not what we had here.
But the question, I guess my question is it the person, the individual plaintiff who is there, is that what can be fixed, or can just anybody come back in later and say, well, no, none of these people who filed suit could ever qualify as administrators, but I did, and so I want to relate back?
I think that, if I understand the question, I think that the court should focus more on the policy behind why we need somebody there, and the focus is, can we get somebody in front of the court to represent this claim, and if we can't, then...
I understand that, and I'm just trying to test how far that goes. So if a lawyer goes in and files suit and says, I'm old, there is a decedent, I think there may be a survival claim out there, but I haven't been able to find anybody yet who's qualified under the statute to bring it. I think that person will materialize at some point, but meanwhile, I'm filing suit to preserve this claim. That would be okay.
Well,
if somebody then later showed up.
If it could be fixed.
Yeah.
Because the focus is, who are we trying to protect here? Are we trying to protect the defendant who doesn't want to pay anybody? Or are we trying to protect the estate?
And that's a good question, because I think there's been an argument made that under the health care Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act, the relation that doctrine should not apply.
I certainly would anticipate that would be the
argument. Indicating that they intended to protect.
Exactly. And how this court kind of dealt with an issue similar to that in the Chilkowitz decision involving Rule 28, And the court in that said, we're not extending limitations. The policy that I think the court talked about several times, the Sachs versus Butler case, I think, was where you said what was intended in the statute was to have some point at which there was certainty and predictability in terms of when a claim would be brought. And that's why the legislature said it was going to be the 2 years and 75 days. In this case, the lawsuit was filed within that. The defendant got notice, both the statutory notice and the lawsuit being filed. So the defendant has received all the notice they ever would have received. They've got a chance to go out and, you know, find their witnesses, go through the medical records, which, by the way, I mean, they already have the medical records because they're the healthcare provider. And they are actually in a much better position to defend that case than the administrator would be, because she's not a, she has no personal knowledge of the claim. It's all the deceased person's claim that's being brought forward. So in that case, this is, you know, we're not extending limitations at all. I mean, this is not some other law that would override or would be disregarded by the Medical Liability Act. It's a procedural rule, just like in many other cases. In fact, I think it's ironic in this particular case, the defendants were the ones who came in the last minute and filed an amended answer and wanted it to relate back, and of course the court granted them to do that. So these procedural things come up, and the court has always allowed pleadings to flesh out what the real issues and who the real parties are.
Wanted what to relate back?
The pleadings. Well, the defendants in this case on the eve of trial,
right,
filed leave to file an amended answer to add additional allegations, and they were granted leave.
But they don't relate back.
Well, if they don't relate back, then I understand. But they were granted leave to amend their petition at their answer at the last minute. As this court can see, I think, from the long line, you've been dealing with these types of issues for 100 years, and probate is a very complex, and it's a somewhat of a messy business. And almost all of these cases that come up come up because of this uncertainty about who ought to bring the claim. Are there heirs? Are there administrators? Are we going to appoint an administrator? And one of the things that strikes me as a real problem here for a probate lawyer is, what if you don't think there's any debts, and you advise your client as the sole heir to go file this lawsuit, and then the defendants now have a real incentive to go out and let's see if we can find some creditors after this limitations run, and then we can prove there's a need for an administration.
But isn't there a need for an administration if the claim's worth more than $2,000?
No, Your Honor. Actually, I think it's typically there's considered to be a necessity for administration if there's more than two claims, if there's more than two creditors. But I don't think there's a dollar amount on.
I thought everybody agreed that the value of the estate was more than $2,000. There's a necessity for administration, no matter how many.
I'm not aware of that provision, probate code. I think you could have, if you had a $1,000 asset and three different people were claiming it, I think the court could still open administration. It would be foolish to do that. I mean,
well, I assume, I assume you hope that this chosen action is worth more than $2,000.
Certainly.
We're wasting our time.
And the thing is, the court has dealt with this before. As far back as the Pope case, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with it, and they've always looked at it from the standpoint of basically it's a harm analysis. Are we harming the estate or are we harming the defendant? If there's no harm to the defendant, then why should we adopt a rule that harms the estate that the administrator is supposed to protect at the expense of the defendant who's out there preparing their defense just like they would have if Carolyn Polk had filed the lawsuit?
You cited Lovato in your brief, and of course we've heard argument today in that case. Are there distinctions between these cases that make a difference? In that case, she was an heir, plaintiff was an heir, wrongful death suit. I mean, there are differences between these two. Is that enough of a reason to say one court got it right and the other got it wrong?
I don't think there's a distinction. There may be a distinction without a difference, because the and this is over the years, the court and certainly the defense has cited you a number of cases that says if there's a necessity for administration, only the administrator can bring the case. Well, if you're an heir, I mean, as I read that, if you're an heir or you're a creditor and you're sitting there and you would love to bring this lawsuit, but there's an administrator in place, unless that administrator just flat says, I'm not going to do it, in which case the court has made exceptions to that rule, the administrator is the person.
But why was your client not an heir?
She's the sister of the deceased, so
the
she would not be a statutory heir, Your Honor.
So why'd she do this? Why don't you jump in and bring a lawsuit?
You know, it's interesting. I guess this was all done at the last minute, so there's not much of a record. I would tell you she's probably a creditor, and she's also was a joint owner in some property that had to be partitioned. And there was nobody else to do it.
No kids, no?
Well, there was a child, but she was, shall we say, not in a position to serve. I think if you focus on the policies, and that's what I'd ask the court to do, is to focus on the policy of why do we have standing? It's not to protect the defendant. The standing requirement is so that the court can make a decision that's going to be binding on everybody. The administrator, once the administrator gets in the case, and this is what the court said in Price versus Anderson, once the administrator is in the case, then it's binding on the estate, and standing is not a problem anymore. And that's what happened here. The court alluded to this in your Embry decision, where Justice Abbott sort of, as an aside, said, you know, the style of that case is a state of, I don't remember the decedent's name, but it was a state of, not executor or administrator or anything like that. And the court said, well, we assume, since nobody raised it, that there's a personal representative and that Mr. Embry is the personal representative and as a plaintiff, and it's okay, and you affirm the case. Certainly, if there was a, if there had been a standing problem there that troubled the court, you'd have been dismissing the case rather than affirming.
She asserted here when she filed the survival action that she was the state representative, and in fact she wasn't.
That's true.
Is that a violation of the Rule 15?
I hope not.
Well, it's
sure, and it illustrates the problem. As I said, a lot of these cases, it's a mistake. I mean, obviously, if we had it to do over again, if Mr. Bagby had it to do over again, we'd do it differently. But
what's the latest point in time that you can?
I'm sorry.
What is the latest point in time that you can mature your standing rights? Is it? Can you do it after judgment, but while the trial court still has plenary jurisdiction? Can you do it on appeal?
Well, there actually there are a couple of cases that I recall, and hopefully they're cited in the brief, where the court has remanded a case. So this court has abated cases to go back.
I'm talking about probate.
Yeah. Well, in probate. I think it would be the same thing if you're until the judgment becomes final. Obviously, once the judgment is final, then the court pretty much loses any ability to fix it. I think, as I recall, there was a case that we came across where the substitution was made while the case was on appeal.
When you say final, you mean all appeals have been taken. So let's suppose
yes.
The administration lingered. The defendant got summary judgment, but then on appeal, the administration came through. Then you would say, aha, we've got standing.
Well, I think that in that situation, you haven't changed. Well, for one thing, if it's a motion for summary judgment, that denotes to me that it would be some kind of a judgment on the merits, which, of course, would not be.
The defendant says she's not an heir, she's not a personal representative. She doesn't have standing capacity to bring the suit. Trial court says, I agree. Summary judgment granted. You take it up on appeal. There's an administration that's pending, and then finally the probate court grants points to the administrator. Can you cure standing that late in the game?
That would be, I think it would, because if you focus strictly on what are we trying to cure, what the court on appeal, what the court wants is, we want to know that this decision is going to be binding on somebody, and once you have that somebody in the lawsuit, then the lawsuit should go forward. We should find ways to decide cases on the merits, as opposed to finding ways to get rid of them and denying people their day in court. So I think
she's
in that case,
she's not asserting that she personally had standing.
No.
Bring a suit never only did.
As a survival action, this is strictly the injury to Carolyn Pope, and the benefits from the suit would go to whoever the heirs and creditors are determined by the probate court to be.
And whoever the representatives of the estate are, no question they would have standing.
Yes.
So why is this a case of standing rather than capacity?
I don't know. I think it's capacity. I think the estate has always been the real party in interest. And the question is, just like, to me, if a corporation files a lawsuit, you have Rule 12 to find out, did the lawyer who filed that lawsuit really represent the corporation? Is he authorized to file that lawsuit? If he's not, well, then that's a problem. I think this is the same situation. You have an estate before the court. Is there somebody authorized to represent that estate? If there's not, then you either fix it or the lawsuit has to be dismissed. In this case, it was fixed. It was fixed before it was ever raised. One of the things that I think the Court of Appeals overlooked, and this court certainly has not, is that there's a long line of cases. And the relation back doctrine really is in two parts. One had been relation back doctrine cases involving pleadings, amending the pleading after limitations, and the courts have said that relates back. That would be the FELA cases, the Pope case and the Wolf case, and the Flores case, for example. And then also you have this idea about the probate relation back, and we have Section 37 that says that when an executor or an administrator is appointed, their authority relates back to the death of the deceased. I think that's very important because from a probate lawyer standpoint, there are a lot of times when family members, the executor named in the will, the administrator who applied, may be faced with a situation where they need to do something. They need to pay a bill. They need to do some kind of a transaction for the benefit of the estate or to protect the estate property. If the court says that Ms. Lorenz didn't have standing and never acquired standing and her appointment didn't relate back, well, then what you're also saying is anytime an administrator does anything for the benefit of the estate before they get those letters, then the debtor who owes money to the estate can come back in and say, oh, sorry, all bets are off. I'm not bound by that agreement. I'm not bound by whatever that transaction was. And the heirs and the creditors of the estate now get harmed, and they thought they were being taken care of. And who? What's the policy for that? Why are we trying to protect the person who owes money to the estate at the expense of the people who rightfully should receive that money? I think that's a policy that's separate and apart from limitations. The Price case dealt strictly with limitations from the standpoint of, was the defendant harmed? In this case, there's no harm, there's never been any harm, and they've never tried to demonstrate any harm. This is on all fours with Price. The real distinction, I think, is that the rule is quite a bit different, or not different, but the policies are different. When you're talking about the plaintiff, the standing of the plaintiff versus the standing of the defendant. In Price, the concern was, did the estate's representative know about the lawsuit? Did the estate's representative have a chance to prepare? Did the estate's representative have a chance to participate? The court found that they did, therefore, no standing problem. From the standpoint of the plaintiff, the defendant is never going to be harmed unless you change the facts of the case or unless you change the identity of the defendant. Just changing the title behind the plaintiff's name doesn't change the defendant's liability one iota, and we're not, and there's nothing in this case that would do that, and we're not asking for a rule that would do that.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please report to Mr. David Walker to present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the first place to start is Ms. Lorenz is not an heir. She doesn't fall into either of the Shepherd exceptions for who can file a survival lawsuit. And so we have to look back at what does that mean to her lawsuit?
It would be, is she not a personal representative? Would she not qualify as a personal representative?
Not at the time she filed her lawsuit or not at the time the limitations period expired.
Why?
And that's the.
Well, what's a personal representative? What does that mean?
She has to be appointed by the probate court to be the personal representative of the estate. Somebody vested with authority, with authority is the right word, but given the justiciable interest in the lawsuit by the probate court, say, yes, you can go sue on behalf of the probate court.
Okay, but isn't that sort of like saying an heir has to be found by the probate court to be an heir as well?
Well,
I mean, can't somebody file as a personal representative and until that's contested, they can bring the suit? It's just more of a question of capacity.
Well, yes and no. It could be a question of capacity if you look at it as to they have the authority to do whatever they want until challenged. The problem of why it really should be is no and should be no is that if they don't have a justiciable interest, why can't I just go file a lawsuit on behalf of Ms. Lorenz and I'll just fix it later? I have no authority to represent Ms. Lorenz or Ms. Polk's estate or Ms. Lorenz either until I'm given the justiciable interest by the probate court saying that I am the administrator or executor of the estate. And that's what didn't happen in this case. She said she was, and that was found to be knowingly false in the trial court. It was not found to be an inadvertent misstatement, but knowingly false.
The Court of Appeals seemed to turn on that all this was a lie. What difference does that make? What if she was just mistaken? She thought her lawyer told her that the letters had been issued and she was the personal representative, and it turns out to be wrong. If it's important that it's a lie, then the case comes out different if she was just mistaken.
Well, at least in that situation where if she was misinformed by her lawyers, she would possibly have a legal malpractice.
She didn't have a lawyer. She filed it herself and didn't know. She just thought she could.
Well, pro se parties are charged with knowing the law just like having a lawyer. And if a lawyer told her the wrong thing.
But lawyers know the law, and when they misstate it, it's not always because they're lying. Sometimes it's because they're mistaken. So pro se, just like a lawyer, files a lawsuit, says I'm the representative. It turns out she's mistaken, but we can't say she was fraudulent. She's just mistaken. Does that case come out different? That doesn't make any difference, does it?
This gets back to who is in the best position to know what who the plaintiff is.
I don't care about that. I'm just trying to decide whether we should pay any attention to the fact that it was a fraudulent lie, which my thinking is we shouldn't if the result would be just the same if she was mistaken.
I could see at least under equity if she was mistaken because she was misinformed by her lawyer.
If she was mistaken, we might like her better, but we can't turn the law on that.
I agree.
And your argument is she just had no authority. She couldn't do it even if she was just mistaken.
That's correct.
So it's irrelevant that she lied. Because the result under your argument in theory is it'd be just the same if she was just honestly in good faith mistaken.
Except for under our Rule 13 argument that she should.
That what? That we can sanction her? What difference does that make about standing?
It makes none.
Okay.
Okay, so she files her pleading. And would it make a difference if she had said, I have filed an application in the probate court and I will be the personal representative because there's nothing to prevent me from doing that. We've done everything we need to do. We don't have the probate court order yet. I will be. That would be okay.
I would say probably not because the probate proceedings have safeguards in place for that sort of exigent circumstance. The probate court can appoint somebody temporary administrator, and so you don't have to wait for the full hearing to be appointed fully the administrator of the estate. Also, the case law has developed some situations for emergency.
If she said, I have applied to be temporary administrator, it's the last day of limitations, and she says, I've applied to be temporary administrator, hadn't happened yet, but my application's there. Standing or no standing?
she would not have standing. But there would be a category of people with standing, and that's the heirs, because the case law has also carved out an exception for the exigent circumstances, the example when the administrator of the estate refuses to file the lawsuit on behalf of the state, the heirs can get together and bring that lawsuit.
So if she filed the suit, instead of saying, I'm the representative of the state, she said, I'm the next friend of the minor who's an heir under the estate, everything would be okay.
Probably, except in this case, the heir was not a minor. The heir is an adult plaintiff, or an adult potential plaintiff who can file a lawsuit on her own behalf. This would then get back to, is the issue, you could then question whether she's really the personal representative of the heir or not, and whether she has standing, because under the family code, traditionally only the court-appointed guardian or the mother and father. The whole concept of standing being, we want to get the right category of people filing lawsuits.
I understand that, but this is what I'm confused about. You say, well, she has no standing. She's not claiming she gets. She's not claiming that she owns the cause of action. She's claiming she's representing an estate that does, and the estate would be hurt. No question that the estate was hurt. So why is this standing? She's saying she's going to collect the money and prosecute the case on behalf of somebody who was hurt. So why is that a problem of standing?
Because it goes to whether she has an interest. She wasn't
hurt.
She's
not asking for the money herself, right?
Well, that would, under your analogy, I would be able to file a lawsuit on behalf of anybody I wanted to say was a plaintiff.
I think that's my question. Could you? And if so, is that a question of capacity or standing?
I think that's a question of standing, and the answer is no. Or at least no. I think the case law says it's no.
If you file it on behalf of some minor who's been beat up, you don't have legal authority to file it because you don't have a proper relationship with the minor. But you're saying this minor has been hurt and this minor needs money, and I'll give the money to the minor. Why is no standing alleged there?
At least historically, this court has treated the issue of whether the person actually filing the lawsuit having an interest is a justiciable interest being a standing question, not a capacity issue.
How would the law be threatened if we were to hold that it is a capacity issue? What damage would be done in the law, which would require the defendant to raise it, you know, and possibly to waive it instead of to?
Well, that would roll back to, it would just allow anybody to file lawsuits, at least with clear-cut standing rules of being harmed and being able to bring it, or either being the right person to bring the lawsuit. Under the standing rules, we limit the class of people that brings the lawsuit. There's all sorts of creative ways that people try to creatively file lawsuits, and that is the way that it limits it.
But you just raise it in capacity. You just say, no, they don't have capacity, as opposed to all the subject matter jurisdiction problems that standing brings with it. I mean, what's the practical difference?
You think defendants won't challenge it anymore if they have to do it by capacity?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And in fact, in another case that we have and that I've argued in the Dallas Court of Appeals, we in fact challenged the capacity also because they were arguing standing versus capacity.
Okay, but so let's say it is standing.
Okay.
And you file it the day before limitations runs. And on that day, you don't really know whether you have standing or not. You filed an application in probate court. You hadn't had a chance to get a temporary appointment. Standing is yet to be determined. Why not apply the relation back on?
Well,
I mean, it's ultimately determined, yes, she does have standing. What's unfair about that?
I would at least argue in the context of the medical malpractice lawsuit, the legislature has pretty much said, don't apply any other laws or equities in this
context.
Okay,
so if it were not a medical malpractice case, would you see any reason not to analyze it that way? Okay, it's standing. That hadn't been determined yet. If she has standing, it'll relate back. Are you only relying on your MLIA argument?
In short, that would always be my fallback position. I think that if you look at the relation back doctrine in the cases that the petitioner has cited, there are some federal court cases, which include the Pope case, Texas applying federal law and following federal rules, and the federal rules of relation back are broader than state court. And if you look at the state court cases they've cited, they apply the same federal rule or they apply different probate rules. If you look in Texas, the Section 37 of the Probate Code is different than the Uniform Probate Code, which is enacted in most of the other state law cases that they've cited.
Go ahead.
I think I'm making a point here. I hope. The The Section 37 only says they have the right to possess the estate as it existed way back when the person died. Under the Uniform Probate Code, it actually says their powers relate back to when the person died. The Texas legislature, in deciding not to enact the probate code, for whatever reason the legislature didn't want to enact the Uniform Probate Code, chose not to invoke the relation back power of the administrator to solve your situation.
Well, okay, let me ask you this. If you've got an estate, a million-dollar estate, and there's only one heir, no debts, does that have to be go through administration?
Well, according to at least my understanding of the rules of probate, and I am not a probate lawyer, and I don't really want to pretend to be one, but it's my understanding any estate that has a value of over $200,000 or has more than two debts needs to go through the probate proceeding. Now, is there harm to not going through some form of probate proceeding? Are there limited? You know, there's all sorts of, you can file the will as a muniment to title. There's lots of minimal probate ways you can go through that. And if it's just cash, the bank account, the bank gives the guy the money where he's got $1 million stashed in his bed and the heir just goes and picks it up. Is there any harm to that? Probably. Nobody would ever know the difference.
Where I'm going here is an argument's been made that there it creates a gotcha situation where a defendant could lie behind the law, never challenge it, capacity, or never challenge standing, wait until limitations is run, go find a creditor somewhere, and there's a gotcha. Now, how do you avoid that?
Well, I'd at least go back to the facts of my case. There's no gotcha here, and gotcha was actually the other way around.
But if we wrote it the way you want us to write it, would it create a potential for a gotcha situation?
It would create the potential for a gotcha, but it always goes back, at least in my mind, to the concept of who is the plaintiff? Am I as the defendant in the best position to know who the plaintiff is? No. The plaintiff is in the best position to know who the plaintiff is. There have been some cases that argue, they should have been shareholders and they filed in the court name.
What if the plaintiff doesn't know who they are? They don't know until they go through the probate process.
How can the plaintiff not know who they are?
Well, but they don't know if they need an administration or not. If you don't know. I mean, you just said you don't know. So the plaintiff doesn't know, and they proceed on two fronts. They find out later, whoops, I made a mistake. I did need it or I didn't need it. So maybe the plaintiff doesn't always know.
We do allow alternative pleadings in the state, and so they could plead, yes, I'm trying to become the administrator. I think that I'm, you know, or I've been appointed the temporary administrator. We're figuring
but
that
I
out.
But I thought
in the
you
court.
Said that if it's later determined they're not.
This goes back to, maybe I should make myself clear. They can always file no. They can always claim in the alternative no estate is pending and none is necessary, or at least none is necessary. If one is pending and they're not appointed the administrator, it would seem that that would be a good fallback position for them that they have standing. But they would have to be an heir. The exception in Shepherd for the non-administrator of the estate only applies to heirs. Miss Lawrence is not an heir and would never qualify unless there's an estate pending to be to represent the estate and file this lawsuit because she's not an heir. So, you know, maybe that should tell people to always bring an heir along with you when you file your lawsuit. I guess it's not meant to. I'm not here meaning this to be a gotcha game, and I would hope that defendants wouldn't play the gotcha game. But it goes back at least to the concept of the plaintiff should know who they are, whether they know ultimately I'm going to be appointed probate or the administrator of the will or the estate or not. That would at least seem to be my position on that because they know whether they've been to probate court or not. They know whether or not there's an estate pending or should know whether or not there's an estate pending.
Something you can find out too and raise early on before limitations is filed. Run ahead, can't you?
Why would we ever? This is exactly what happened in this case. We had no reason to think about that except for in our getting ready for the trial. We thought, well, they've not produced this stuff to us in discovery like we asked for. Let's just walk over to the probate court and see what we can find. And then we found that this situation existed that she wasn't. And then we thought, well, she's not an heir, and thus we're here. And that's why, although Justice Brewster would not like for us to not think that this knowing falsehood made a difference. It did make a difference in how we got here, because we actually relied on what they told us at the beginning of the lawsuit, that she was the administrator.
But if you found out before limitations had run, you could just wait till limitations had run and then bring it up and say she's out of court. I mean, and you're not prejudiced in any way. You know who's being sued and why, and who's suing you and why, and
but
lost nothing that the statute of limitations is designed to protect.
Well, except for that, it all ends, standing or statute of limitations, all at some end have a part that's harmful to some party or another. And correct, in the equities, we haven't lost anything necessarily in the equities, but jurisdiction, you don't get to apply the equities.
If it's just capacity, then that's something you could raise at any point in the lawsuit that could be cured, isn't that correct?
That's my understanding of how capacity is dealt with.
And you wouldn't be harmed as far as limitations being prepared. If a total stranger files a lawsuit saying I'm the representative, then as you say, when you find out that's not true, you get Rule 13 sanctions against them for a total stranger doing it. On the other hand, if it's a sister that files a lawsuit when it should have been a child that filed the lawsuit, both of them for the person who's undoubtedly died, you knew from the start what the case was. This was a medical malpractice case. You're just substituting somebody. Really, you're just substituting somebody to sit in the chair who has no knowledge of any of the facts of the case.
What?
You're substituting a representative. So how could a defendant possibly be harmed by that?
At the very least, that would get back to what the legislature told us. The legislature, in its choosing for doctors, decided we're going to extend the statute of limitations by 75 days from ordinary people.
The reason they made it firm was because they wanted you to be ready, timely, to have the medical records and the nurses and everybody still there, be prepared. And the person who sits in the representative's chair doesn't affect any of that.
But they also wanted to not apply any other laws to that is the why we gave them another 75 days, among other reasons. But you are correct. It doesn't necessarily affect whether I know what is contained within the medical records.
So then you'd argue Chilkowitz is wrong because we actually... We changed who the named defendant was.
Well, but in Chilkowitz, that goes back to at least what I would say is the distinction between the cases where the defendant is wrong versus the cases where the plaintiff is wrong. In the cases where the defendant is wrong, defendants sometimes create arcane or bizarre corporate structures, and so it's hard for the plaintiff to figure out.
The probate code doesn't.
The probate code may. But it's easier for the plaintiff to know who is filed on behalf, who has been appointed to represent the estate, versus if the estate is sued, the plaintiff may not know where the estate is even been filed. And so there is a big difference between Chilkowitz and this case because when you have defendants who have corporate structures that can be difficult to navigate the maze, you at least may want to cut the plaintiff some slack in that case. And also, let's not forget that in those cases where defendants are there, someone is in the court withstanding. The plaintiff is standing, holding the jurisdictional court open, whereas when the plaintiff is wrong, nobody is standing there with the door open.
But you know exactly what the lawsuit was about from the first day you got it. This was a lady.
I didn't work on this lawsuit, I must confess, until...
Whoever got the plea. The doctor knew the day he got the pleading what this case was about.
I imagine. I do sometimes represent doctors who get claims and who say, I have no idea who that person is or whatever. But yes, as a general rule, the doctor knows what's going on and what it's about once they get the lawsuit.
And as a general rule, the whole policy behind limitations is to give that doctor fair notice of the claim with a reasonable opportunity to contact witnesses while their minds are fresh. And that doctrine would survive our holding that this is a capacity question since the suit was filed within limitation rather than standing question. Isn't that right?
It would, Your Honor.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. In my final remarks, first of all, Your Honor, in going back to your question about what you would do if the case was on appeal, that happened in the Duett case that was cited in the brief. In that case, the suit was filed by a state of Duett, and that was the only title that was ever used. but the executor of the estate participated and apparently signed some affidavits in the course of the proceeding. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals said, we'll just amend the judgment to reflect that the judgment is you know, John Dewitt, executor for the estate of Mr. Dewitt. And that's how they cured it. They didn't even send it back. They just fixed it. One question that I think the court has alluded to that I'd like to present is with this idea of the heir filing a lawsuit. Okay, the heir thinks they're the lawsuit. They think they have a claim. I'm the sole heir. There's no debts to be paid. And then 2.5, 3 years later, somebody finds a will. And the will left everything to somebody else. All of a sudden, I'm no longer an heir. And under the defendant's rule, the lawsuit goes away because I'm not an heir anymore and I don't have any standing and never had standing because the will would relate back to the date of the death. And the executor in the will would now be the person, the only person with standing. And you've got 4 years to probate that will. That seems to me to be a very unfair rule that has no benefit to a defendant other than it's a gotcha rule. And I just think the court should really think hard before adopting a gotcha rule to deny people a trial on the merits, because it seems to me having a trial on the merits and deciding cases on their facts rather than on technicalities is a good policy. Also, I would point out that, to my knowledge, I've never, other than the Bozeman case, which alluded to the relation back after a representative was appointed, I don't know that there's any cases in Texas that have directly said what the effect is of appointment on acts that are taken by that administrator before her appointment. From what I can tell, the great weight of authority is that it relates back and ratifies whatever she's done prior to her appointment. And I don't think this court has ever said that's not the law or that that's not the rule. And really, if you read those cases in the context of Probate Code 37, that's sort of what that says, that the authority relates back to the death of the decedent, and you have possession of all the property, including this claim, as of the death of the decedent. It may be that the legislature didn't adopt the Uniform Probate Code because 37 was already there, and why rewrite something that's already on the books? The other thing that counsel mentioned, I would invite the court to go back and read Pope from the standpoint that I don't think they were applying federal rules. There was a federal statute involved, but as I understand it, those FVLA cases were decided under state law procedures and were actually, I guess, diversity cases, or the Pope case was a state case. It was a state law case under the state law rules, and federal rules of civil procedure certainly wouldn't apply to that. I think that's just consistent with this court's long history of allowing the relation back in pleadings cases where you're not changing the defendant and you're not changing the facts and the cause of action that it's based on. The salient point in this case that I think supports the policy that we're asking the court to adopt is that this was Carolyn Polk's claim, and it's always been Carolyn Polk's claim. There's never been a question, well, are these damages suffered by Cynthia Lorenz or somebody else? In this case, it wouldn't matter who the administrator was. The administrator could be anybody in this room, and it wouldn't change one fact in the case. And so why should we adopt a rule that would take away the rights of the beneficiary, which would hinder the creditors of the estate, and there's no detriment to the defendant, and a huge harm to those people who are involved.
Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the argument in this case, and the court will now take another brief recess.